Today's Taisho will be on Case 48 in the Mumonkan, Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to nirvana. I still wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." Umon's comment: one, going to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Mumon's verse: before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before a tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. This is the third day of our spring 2011 Sesshin. And as I pointed out this morning, there was a real transformation in the room. We had a young woman here, Megan, who is an undergraduate. And she has not done much sitting before. And she came here to the Sesshin, I think, like many people, somewhat unprepared for such a lot of sitting. I guess everybody who comes to Sesshin for the first time is unprepared for what follows. She got through the first night. She got through the next day. And basically, about halfway through the second day, she told me she wanted to leave. And I think the spectacle of other people leaving was just too much for her to take. So she came to see me, I guess, toward the end of the day yesterday, toward the end of the, around before dinner, I believe, or after dinner. And she said, I want to leave. And I asked her to come into my room, and we sat down, and I said, it's such a shame when people leave after just 2 days, because a lot of the time they're in a great deal of pain. And I noticed this. I noticed Whitney was in a lot of pain sitting across from me, and I could see a couple other people yesterday, really struggling to get through day two. So I said to her, if you just stick it out until basically lunch tomorrow, you're likely to see a real change. Well, she didn't quite make it to lunch, but she did see a change. And yesterday, she was moving and moving and moving and moving. And this morning, when she got up and sat, I noticed she didn't move the first sit at all, even though it was 40 minutes long. And she adjusted her posture, but she didn't move during the second sit. The last sit was only 15 minutes long, if you were thinking your concentration was very deep. No such luck. It was only 15 minutes. She did put her head on her knees, pulled her knees up and put her head on her knees and looked very miserable at the end of the second sit. But to her credit, Once we got the third sit underway, she finally resumed a proper posture. And, she looked quite miserable when she was leaving. And I said, you know, didn't you notice how still you sat this morning? And she did say yes. And I said, please come back. You would be most welcome to come here again. And she didn't say, okay. She did, looked pretty abject. But the interesting thing to me was that she stayed here for 2 days, and also that she sat so still on the last day. And also, by the way, when we were talking in her room, I said, please tell me what happens when you watch the breath. And it was such a meticulously correct description that I said, I'm really impressed by your ability to tell me these details about what happens when you breathe. And I said, you were really very attentive, and I was really impressed. She didn't seem pleased. She just seemed a little shell-shocked. But I told her, probably in a couple of days, you're going to feel very good. You're going to feel very, very good. And you won't know why, but please remember, partly it was because you did Zazen for 2 days. Everybody was pretty restless yesterday, a lot of people. And I noticed this morning people sat so still, and that's a real triumph. I have to say that other people in the room too, today are just transformed. They're transformed. You know, straight spine, very, very different from the other day. And I remember the first time I ever noticed this was a long time ago. It was a session many, many years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And I was on a session with one of our people in our group was a woman named Corinne Friedlander. And her husband, whose name was Richard Egemeyer, came to Sesshin. She had gotten her husband to come to Sesshin, even though he wasn't a Zen enthusiast. And he was transformed by the experience. His face at the end of the Sesshin was 10 years younger. It just was so obvious that the tense tension. Was out of his face, and he looked younger. He looked, every once in a while you'll see a picture of children at ease, and their faces have a kind of easiness or openness, And his face looked like a little kid's face. It was so open, and it was so at ease, I just remember being deeply moved, and we all go through this process. We come to Sesshin with tensions and fears, and sometimes they wake us up at night, and it's like we're storm-tossed and we're pulled in this direction and that direction. And then if we go through this process around day three, it's like there's a cracking in our hearts. And it opens up, and this beautiful, beautiful awareness comes out. This beautiful mind. And maybe this hasn't happened to you yet, but if you keep sitting, we have like a hard shell, and we've grown this hard shell because life can be. Very, very difficult and frightening, disappointing, challenging. And we can get to be quite hard on others or hard on ourselves, But then when we come to Sesshin, as I say, day one, you're just thinking about your problems. Day two, you're just trying to stay alive. And day three, it's like the shell inside cracks open. And this beautiful, beautiful compassion can come out. And it may not be that dramatic. You may not think, oh my goodness, beautiful compassion. But you'll notice, that your mind is empty, and when you look at, say, a bowl of rice in front of you, it's just utterly present to you. You know, you're not... Normally, there's like a screen of thoughts between ourselves and the world. It's like this very heavy screen of thoughts. And then, you know, on day three of Sesshin, you look down and the screen of thoughts, the turmoil in your heart is gone, and there's a kind of pure presence. And this is called tat-at-tagat. This is called tat-ata, which is pure presence. And just the pure presence of the rice, the pure presence of the wind, the pure presence of... And of course, also, when we get off the cushion and we're in an environment like this, you know, we sometimes notice other people, and we might notice them with great affection. Often we don't notice other people with great affection. You know, often what happens to us is that we're sort of like a buffeted about, and we're knocked this way and that, either by our own selves or by others, you know. And we can, as I say, we can become kind of hard-hearted, and also very hard on ourselves. You know, very seldom are we good judges of ourselves. You know, we imagine that most people let themselves off the hook pretty easily, you know. We imagine that most people think well of themselves. Actually, I find it's very difficult for some people to think well of themselves, you know. So anyway, on day three of Sesshin, sometimes it's possible to begin to experience other people in this spirit of real gratitude, even love, you know, where you begin to realize, I'm so glad that this person is in the world, you know, and what a great gift it is to be here with this person, or with these people. And this doesn't always happen at Sesshin, and it doesn't always last, you know. I was at a Sesshin once where two people were not getting along very well. And one person, two women actually, were not getting along very well. And there was a lot of tension between them. And one of the women had been sitting for 3 days and came into the Dokusan room and sat down and said, you know, I want to say something about, I'll say the woman's name was Betty. I want to say something about Betty. And I thought, uh-oh, here we go again, you know. But instead, the person said, you know, Betty is very intelligent and very beautiful, and I'm just jealous of her. And I thought, wow, you know, what a breakthrough. What a beautiful breakthrough. You know, that happened around day three of a Sesshin, where somebody's shell cracked open. And so I thought after the Sesshin, Betty would go up to, this woman would go up to Betty and give her a big hug. But it didn't happen. I'm sorry to say that person's heart hardened again. And so I hope, I pray that this process will go on and this person will have another opening. Today I was thinking about all the people I've sat with in my life, you know. I hope you don't mind if I get sentimental. But I was thinking about, I started sitting in 1977 with a group. I had heard about the Seattle Zen Center. And I went to sit with a man named Genki Roshi, Genki Takabayashi. And the sitting, just getting through 20 minutes, was so difficult. I started going every Wednesday night to sit there, And then I went to my first sesshin, and it was such a shock. It was just murder. But there was something about Genki Roshi that I found so inspiring. It was as though it had been foreordained that I would be his student, because I just found my heart was lifted, or a powerful emotion was stirred by him, and I became his faithful student for many years. And you know, later I studied with another person named Webb Roshi, and again I think of him so precious, you know. And I was thinking this morning of all the people I used to practice with, you know, John Sunston, Bill Kugler, all of these people that I practiced with. And I must say, I feel like I'm going to get out of this sesshin and I'm going to go call them all and say, how are you doing, man? You know, because it was really precious, really precious. There's something very precious about the way our life unfolds, even if it's not what we plan. You know, and it's always not what we plan. When you're in day three mind, when you're in day one mind of sesshin, day one mind is like this. I'm so unhappy with X aspect of my life. And it's like, I didn't get that raise, or this didn't happen to me, you know, how unfair. One of the people who came to our sesshin this time was Brian Tucker. And Brian Tucker and I have been practicing together, I think, for 8 years, something like that. Maybe longer than that now. He was an interfaith director at the Vincentian Renewal Center. And he heard about our group somehow, and he called me up on the phone and invited me to meet with him and asked me if I wanted to start teaching meditation in Princeton. And I said yes, and he's been practicing, we've been practicing together ever since. But anyway, Brian has been coming to sesshin for a long time, and he came to sesshin just for 2 days this time. And he said, I really wanted to stay longer, but they laid off 70 people in the business where I work. And he said, that's never happened before. And I think he was afraid, you know, not to be there. He was afraid he might get laid off. So he really had a wonderful experience. I know how difficult it must have been on day one for him. He must have been thinking about you know, his job, the job prospect. He must have been thinking about, he's had some difficulties with his significant other who's had health issues. So, you know, he's in a relationship with somebody who has health problems, and his job is on the line, and he came to sesshin, and I think that in itself is remarkable. You know, he's coming here to deal with this problem. And by the end of day two, he felt much, much better. In fact, he said, I'll be back very soon. You know, I want to do this again very soon. You know, his mind was so much more open by the end of the second day. And he was more relaxed and he was more trusting. So, you know, this koan is such an interesting koan. It's such a beautiful koan. It goes like this. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, it is written, there are holy ones in the 10 directions, and only one road leads to nirvana. I wonder where the road can be. See? So the koan is like this. I look north, east, south, and west. I look northeast, northwest, you know. And I see a holy one in each direction. And if I look up, I see a holy one. And if I look down, I see a holy one. So where should I go in my life? Where should I go in my life? Now, for young people, this is a really crucial question, right? Because, young people look at life and they say, everything's ahead of me. Should I become a doctor? Should I become a journalist? And they want to make the right choice. And sometimes the choices seem to be blocked. So a young person has the dilemma of multiple directions, right? If I do this, I'll be on that road. If I do that, though, I'll be on this road. And so it says holy ones in the 10 directions, but only one of those directions is the right road. Which do I pick? So there's 10 directions, and I could go to this holy one north, or to this holy one south, or to this holy one east, or to this holy one west. But which one do I take? And we spend a lot of time when we're younger, perhaps agonizing over these decisions. Shall I be this or shall I be that? Now older people have a different perspective on all of this, because they've already walked down some of these roads. So an older person has made a choice, right? But then that older person looks back at the choice and says, oh gee, why did I choose this road? If only I'd chosen that road. This is quite common. This is a younger person and older person looking at life, right? And the younger person says, oh, everything before me is open, but I'm scared because which one do I choose? And the older person looks and says, oh, if only I'd chosen the other road, Okay. So, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're 25 years old, you can be very worried about choosing the right road. You might say, which will I do? Will I do public interest law or corporate law? And you say, well, if I do corporate law, I'll be rich, but corrupt. If I do public interest law, I'll be poor, but virtuous. Right? Okay. So you have a choice, it seems, yeah? An older person might be public interest lawyer and say, oh dear, why did I do this? I wish I had a Lamborghini like Smith down the street, and instead I'm stuck with this Toyota Tercel, right? If only I had gone into corporate law, everything would be better. Okay. So, this koan is actually, I think, a very powerful koan because, in a certain sense, we have to choose in life all the time. We have to make choices. And choosing means you don't take this road, you take this road. And once you take that road, you can't take the road you didn't choose, right? You've made a choice. And it's scary going into it, and it can be haunting coming out of it, Okay, so this is so important, I think, because this is such an element of life. But the koan is basically, are you going to make the right choice? Or it's why didn't you make the right choice? See, the koan is sort of pulling at your heartstrings in a way. Okay. So it is written, holy ones in the 10 directions, one straight road is ahead to nirvana. I wonder where that road can be. And Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, here it is. Now this is really Zen. This is the essence of Zen. Difficult to live up to, yes, I think. But from the Zen standpoint, let me read you the second part before I go into that. Later, the monk... Now look, you can choose north, east, south, west. You can't choose north and south. So you have to make a choice. And once you've made the choice, then you might be filled with regret because you didn't take the other road. Okay. So how are we supposed to choose? What is the right road is the question. Right? What is the right road? Now, the question, and the first part of this koan ends with, Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and Kenpo just draws a line in the air. They said, which is the right direction? And Kenpo takes his staff, and in the air he draws a line, and he says, that's the right direction. Okay? It just draws it in the air. Now, what does that mean? What kind of an answer is that? Okay, now, we don't know, but we get a little bit more information. Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, this fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents. Okay. Now, I think this is really a beautiful koan because it has this little hint in it, you know. Somebody asked Umon the same question. You know, there's Bhagavats in the 10 directions. Which is the right road? And he takes his fan and he says, this fan goes right up to the top of heaven. And it leaps right to the top of the heaven and it goes to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. Okay. Now, what does this mean? What does all this mean? Well, I think it means something like this, you know. My personal feeling is that the koan is really saying that when we choose, you know, well, let me put it this way. Sometimes you don't really choose, you know what I mean? Sometimes the choice unfolds for you because your true nature is telling you what to do. So basically, I try to be sensitive to what makes me feel most connected and alive and compassionate. I think those things go together. Some things don't do that for me, you know. So I had a chance recently to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I'm sorry, the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. And I was walking through the building, and I was walking by one show after another. And I was sort of quickly doing the building, and I walked into this room, and there were some etchings by some famous artist, contemporary artist, and it didn't speak to me. And then I went into another room, and there were some etchings by an artist, and again, it didn't speak to me. Then I went into a room, and there were some photographs, and so on and so on. But then I walked into this room, and it was a retrospective of expressionist art, American expressionist art from the 50s. And it was like my hair stood on end. You know, I just felt so alive and so moved by this, you know. And so I would say that was my path, right? That was my path. Because I felt alive. I felt moved deeply and awake. I would say that choosing the, I chose to stay there in a way, right? But really I was drawn to staying there because it made me feel more alive. And I suppose that this is how people live their lives if they're alive. You know, it's possible to make decisions that aren't decided in this way. So it's possible to do something because it's expected, or to do something because it's because of fear, right? Out of fear. Or anger. You do something for revenge or something like that. But sometimes we do things because it makes us feel more alive. And that's a complicated issue, right? I mean, what makes us feel more alive? But when you feel alive, and you know when you don't. You know when the fan leaps to heaven and when it doesn't, you know. And so that's sort of the Zen ideal. The Zen ideal of a life well lived is the life that comes from this place where this energy surges up and you feel alive and connected. Full of love, full of care, you know. Okay. So this is the Zen life. And I think it's difficult, actually, for people to live this way. Because we are often told, you know, this is the right road. This is the one way. And usually people become confused because we get all these mixed messages in life, and we get intimidated, or we become confused. We think this is what we should want. This is who we should be. But basically, that way of living causes us a lot of distress and unhappiness. And often because of that distress and unhappiness, we decide to come to Sesshin. And so I would say Sesshin is all about learning how to be an authentic human being. And that's very difficult. It's difficult in all kinds of ways. But being an authentic human being from the Zen standpoint is learning how to crack open that shell and let that beautiful being come out. You know, sometimes I make decisions myself out of fear, you know, fear. So I will not do something because I'm afraid that the consequences might be bad. And sometimes I'll do things out of habit, you know, like out of inertia. And sometimes I'll do things really out of selfishness, you know. And I'll justify my behavior in some way. But sometimes I get in touch with this energy, this wonderful compassionate energy that we find on the third day of Sesshin. And this is sort of like how we live our lives if we're Zen people. You know, sometimes that energy just isn't there, you know. And if it isn't there, that's a problem. And Sesshin is all about learning how not to be blocked, you know. So sometimes when you're working on a koan, and especially if it's a koan that deals with something in your life that's difficult, you know, you're blocked, you know. You keep trying to answer the koan or access the koan, and you can't get through it, you know. And it might seem at times that you'll never get through that koan. But when you begin to work through the koan, there's usually this feeling or this experience of opening up, and there's a kind of energy that arises, yeah. And it's like stirring. It's an unconscious. Elsewhere in the Mumonkan, it's called unconscious stirring. But it's like, you know, I was walking through the museum and I looked at this room, nothing. I looked at this room, nothing. And I suddenly went into this room and all of a sudden I felt this stirring. It's like I came to life. I came to life. And those moments in life are important moments when you come to life, you know. I have made a lot of mistakes in my life, but usually not because I listened to that energy. Usually because I didn't listen to that energy, you know. I said something, and I might have said it in a teisho, and I'd like to retract it at this time. I said, basically, that all roads are equally good. See, what I said was, for a Zen person, basically, it doesn't matter whether you're here or there, or somewhere else practicing. Any sangha is as good as any other sangha, and any relationship is as good as any other relationship. And that was, for that I should have my mouth washed out with soap. And I apologize to everyone for speaking such a falsehood. You would think that's true, wouldn't you? Don't discriminate. But actually, I don't think that's true anymore. I have learned something new. And what I realize is that, you walk down the road and you realize there's not energy here. And then you walk down another road and you realize, oh my God, this beautiful energy. See? And now sometimes you can second guess yourself. You walk down the road and you say, this is beautiful energy, but you say, oh, this isn't the road I should be walking down. Or some people have problems with trusting themselves. And they're, even though they're getting the energy, they say, should I be getting this energy? Do I deserve this energy? Or they'll say, any energy that was good enough to come to me is not good energy, right? Some people would say, any energy that would come to me is lousy energy because I'm a lousy person. You know, Groucho Marx used to say, any country club, I wouldn't want to be a member of any country club that would let me in. See? In other words, he actually had self-esteem problems. So sometimes we make a choice in life and things go well. And instead of saying, gee, this is my energy, we say, oh, well, if they're going well, this can't be the right road for me, because they're not supposed to go well. So anyway, I was wrong to say all roads are equally equal. They're not equal. That's an idealist perspective. Basically, you walk down one road and there's energy, and it's alive, and it's alive. And you walk down another road and there's no energy. And there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference between those two roads. They're not all the same. That I was mistaken, and I apologize. When you walk down a road and you have that energy in life, it's very precious, you know? And nobody who is awake will regret walking down that road. And so it's special. I've met so many people in my life, but only some of them do I remember. You know, so for example, in our Zen group in Seattle, there was Bill Kugler, there was John Sunston, there were 30 other people, maybe 40 other people whose names I don't even know, but some of them were really precious to me. There was a kind of karmic compatibility. And basically, it was just like, you feel like I was destined to be your friend, you know? And now, that sounds so crazy, right? To say, what do you mean? Somebody you knew this person in a previous life, or somebody wrote, God decided you should meet, you know, and said, like puppets, hello, you know. But maybe that's not what it means. It means that you know, basically, we live a little bit of our lives consciously. You know, we live a little bit of our lives consciously. But much of our life is unconscious, you know? And the Zen view is that the deepest part of ourselves is not conscious. You know, why when I walked into that room and saw those paintings on the wall did my heart soar? I don't know. But it just did, see? It was an unconscious stirring. And the same thing is true, you know, in life. We walk down one road and everybody says this is the road to be on, but somehow nothing's stirring. And then we walk down another road and it's like, oh my God, you know, this is so exciting. This is the road I'm supposed to be on. And so, you know, it's hard sometimes to be alert to or awake to that energy. We live sometimes too much in the social script. You know, we think this is what I should do. I should do corporate law. You know, but maybe one day you're reading a case in environmental law and your heart is racing, and you feel alive. You know, that's where maybe you should go. You know, that's what you should do. Your mind becomes bright and clear. How do we learn how to trust ourselves? You know, one way to think about Sesshin is that we're learning how to be honest people, or we're learning how to be, we say, follow our true nature. In Zen, there's this idea of true nature. And that means that the whole being comes alive. The whole being comes alive. You know, the deeper levels of our consciousness, which are unconscious, stir in a way that is deeply moving and powerful. So you know, some people think of Zen, of enlightenment, as like an emotionless state. But actually, the state of awakening involves the whole being. This is very much a Mahayana view, the whole being. And so it's, you know, it has an intellectual character, but it has this deeper unconscious character, subconscious stirring. So basically, when you look back on your life, if you are not careful, you know, you will have many regrets. But if you look back on your life and you have lived for that energy, I think it will be easier for you to be happy with your life, you know. And if you're wondering about which way to go forward in your life, you know, again, I would say listen to that energy. Listen to that energy. Pay attention. Now, you might be thinking, well, what if it tells me to rob a bank? What if it tells me to rob a bank? But I would say that probably you need to do more zazen. That's how I usually get out of these questions. Is to say, just do more zazen, and that will give me a chance to think about the answer. But I think we aren't really fully awake and alive when we're... I think you have to be quite closed up to do harm to somebody else. And I think when we're really awake, when we're really on the right road, we are in that day three heart. You know, last night, I've been doing this for 35 years, so I get to day three heart a little faster than other people. And last night, I was walking around looking at people, and maybe some people thought I was crazy, because I'm walking around looking at people like they're a puppy dog, or, you know, like I want to give everybody a big hug. And sometimes I do, you know. And please don't think it's disingenuous. It's totally real. I'm very moved to see you, you know. Actually, like, totally, you know. And somebody could say, well, you're just high on Zazen, but I don't think that's true. I think that's a Buddha heart. That's Buddha heart. That's Bodhisattva heart. You know, so I would not dream of robbing a bank with Bodhisattva heart, you know, unless I would say rob the bank and then split the proceeds with the teller, you know. But in Bodhisattva heart, that would be a good robbery, in my opinion, and the other people in the bank, right? But otherwise, I wouldn't rob the bank. So basically, the path with heart, the correct road, is the road that produces this energy. And it takes a little sitting sometime to know what the right energy is, and we can get very confused about that. But as long as we feel that loving kindness, we know we're on the right road, and I believe that, you know. And when you're in the day three of Sesshin, heart, you know, that's really like solid gold, you know. You can really trust that. And so we're now in a place that's really special. And we're with people who are really, you know, we all have some of the Groucho Marx mindset, right? It's like, I have a friend of mine who is really quite callous to his friends, you know. And I was really, his name is Daniel. And Daniel kind of like is really callous to his friends. And it took me a long time to figure out why he acts this way. I mean, he works with people and he doesn't go, would you do me a favor? Would you do this? He says, take this away, right? It's like, Daniel, they're not your servants, you know. These are people you work, these are your co-workers and hopefully your friends. And you take this away. And I realized he doesn't really like himself very much, you know. So I think he treats other people with contempt because he thinks, well, if they like me, I must not, they must be idiots, you know, because I'm such an unlikable person. I know that sounds odd, but I think that's how Daniel really works. So anyway, there are such people in the world. But when we are on the cushion, you know, and when we're in day three mind, one of the most amazing things, the most amazing thing, is not that you might want to go around and slobber on somebody and go, I really love you, you know. Because that's hard. That takes 3 days of sitting sometime to feel that. Maybe many sesshin. But you know, it's even harder it's even harder to get up and say to yourself, oh, you know, I really love you. That's very hard. That's the, I think, harder than anything else sometime, you know. So anyway, if that happens to you, don't think it's narcissism, right? Narcissism is like, I'm working really hard to like myself, but I don't, you know. There are people who are just naturally comfortable with themselves. And those people are quite accomplished, you know. If you ever see the Dalai Lama, it's so interesting to watch him because he's so unpretentious. You know, he came to Rutgers and he spoke at Rutgers. And, you know, if I were going to address a stadium full of people, I would be so nervous because I'd be thinking, I'm the Dalai Lama. I've got to say something profound. I've got, you know, there's thousands of people here. I've got to say something memorable, clever, moving. You know, you could get up and give a speech and you could try so hard to be impressive or to be profound or spiritual. And the Dalai Lama, you know, I think he put on a funny hat and he just, you know, he said, you know, hi, or, you know, be good people or something like that. And some people were offended in a way because he didn't work harder. But I thought he's absolutely right, you know. He obviously likes himself, you know. And and uh, And I, you could say, well, he likes himself because he's the Dalai Lama. Who wouldn't like your, you know? But on the other hand, you know, actually, it would be very hard to be the Dalai Lama and like yourself, because everybody's telling you you're perfect all your life, and you must be quite aware of how imperfect you are. And so, you know, the Dalai Lama must have gotten up. He meditates 3 or 4 hours a day, every day. He must get up, and he must have done a lot of zazen trying to get over the fact that he's not perfect, you know. But probably one day, on day 3 of Sesshin, or whatever Tibetans do, that's like Sesshin, he must have gotten up and said, you know, and I even like myself. I even love myself, which is quite wonderful. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, it is written, there are holy ones in the 10 directions, but only one straight road to nirvana. I still wonder where that road can be. Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line and said, right here. Later, the monks asked the same question of Umo, who held up his fan and said, this fan strikes jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents. See, that's energy for you. See? Okay. Mumon's comment. One, going up to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go. Each stretches out his hand to support the profound meaning. For you, it's letting go. For her, it's holding fast. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Beware that Mumon is playing with us there. He's messing with us. He means they both are living full lives. Mumon's verse, before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. See, it's like unconsciously this is already unfolding. Okay. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. One way to think of it is we're going through life in uncertainty, but another way to think of it is this is an unfolding of a deep, deep pattern, like a mandala. This is the unfolding of a deep mandala. And at this moment, all of us are together in this beautiful mandala. And it's so precious to be here with you. It's so precious to be here with you. Thank you.